We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara,
me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me,
and me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons and Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Michael and I have gotten together to talk about the end of the season as part of our first part of a two-part series going into the offseason. And this show will talk about the last two games of the playoff series, and then we'll break down each individual player, grade them, and, you know, talk about what we think they need to do moving forward. Michael, what do you want to talk about in those last two games, the two that the Lakers just finally turned it on and shut things down?
Yeah, and it was a combination of that. They turned it on, but also the Hornets just didn't seem to make the adjustments that they needed to make in the series. I mean, you might get beat later on in a series, but you should be at least playing your best basketball at the end, or at least have made adjustments where you could match up better. It seemed like the Hornets made all of the wrong adjustments, or they just went away from the things that were working early on. I do want to give the Lakers credit. I knew that they were better than they had shown in the first four games and that they would turn it on, but I don't think it was 100% them in these last two games.
No, and I think as bad as it is, part of it's the fact that Okafor played better in the last two games, because mm-hmm. I kept Gray's butt nailed to the bench. And believe it or not, Gray, I would say, was our best center in that series without any question.
So, I mean, do you think it was purely that, or do you think there was some kind of injury concern that maybe Gray's ankle was acting back up and he just really couldn't go? Because he did give some good minutes, and I just find it hard to believe that Monty couldn't find more time to get him on the floor, especially when Bynum was just so dominant.
I mean, he was actually playing the rotations again, as always, the matchups. And he would put Gray in there. When Okafor wasn't available, he would put Gray in there if Bynum was playing. And in those last two games, Bynum still had some foul trouble, so Gray got really limited minutes because Okafor was getting a lot of minutes because he wasn't in the foul trouble. He'd been in all series. And if Bynum wasn't in, Monty didn't seem interested in having Gray play, which I thought he did well against Gasol, too. I was not impressed with Gasol's ability to move out there in that series. He just didn't work, and Gray could stay with him. So yeah. I think this is that's the number one thing. all year long that's been Monty's downfall is he's got to have his defensive matchups on the floor, and that's what he's concerned about. He will play the person he thinks matches up best defensively, and that's his primary concern. And, you know, that cost us with Thornton, because Thornton was never the best defensive matchup with anybody, because you could always argue that Willie was a little better or Bellinelli was a little better. So Marcus, even though his offense was 30% better than either of them, never saw the light of day.
Yeah, I don't know. I just got a strange feeling that wasn't it with Gray, because Monty had no problem playing Gray earlier in the series, especially in Game 1 before he got hurt. I mean, in Game 6, he gives 14 minutes to Jason Smith and 7 to Banga. And I can't imagine that he's given those 21 minutes to those guys if Gray is fully healthy. I think, you know, Gray tried to play through the ankle in games, 3 and 4. Thinks it probably acted back up. I mean, when I first saw that injury, and you saw it as well,
mm-hmm.
we both thought he was out for the series, and I think he tried to tough it out, and he got a couple of minutes in the last two games. But if I really had to guess, I think that was just more injury than rotation, and Monty just he didn't want to throw him under the bus and probably didn't mention anything to the press. But just it just strikes me a little weird that you're telling me that he had enough faith in Banga to give him 7 minutes, but not in Aaron Gray. I don't know. I thought it was an injury thing. But either way, I mean, let's not act like that cost the Hornets this series.
No, absolutely not. I mean,
it's just my intuition.
And I noticed you were so sneakily sneaking into my live chat to ask that.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Pointed question about how brilliant you were about how their defense would you know, jump on us. And I mean, honestly, their defense did ratchet up a little bit, but the lucky ass shots, I can't even say that. Our team regressed to what it was through the whole season. Our team was a jump shooting team. I made that post about how they had the worst shot selection of any team in the league because the shots they took, you know, generate a really low percentage on average in the NBA. And they just started taking those shots more. And when you take that kind of shot, eventually you'll get really shitty results. And when you combine that with a team that is offensively really solid that you're going against, you end up losing by 18 points.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, you know, when your point guard has 5 turnovers, when he's usually, you know, when Chris Paul plays his best, he has a stat line of 14 assists, 1 turnover.
Mm-hmm.
That game, he was just getting a little flustered. So the Hornets had 14 in that game. And honestly, that game could have been even uglier because throughout the series, they were missing free throws. In that game, they made nearly all of their free throws, going 17 of 18.
Yep.
So, you know, that game could have been worse.
That number right there, 18. I mean, I was stunned through the first 4 games because we didn't have a major disadvantage. I mean, there was a slight one, but it wasn't a huge disadvantage in free throws. And yeah. You'd expect the Lakers to punish us in free throws because we're jump shooters.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, surprisingly, though, as much as fans love to believe that the refs are on the Lakers' side, the Lakers are actually right in the middle of the pack in both categories as far as free throws attempted and also free throws given up. So they're actually not a team that usually has a large discrepancy over the course of the year. I think that's a little bit of people thinking about the past back in the days when Kobe just attacked hard and he would get 20 free throws against the Utah Jazz.
And Shaq would just pull game.
Yeah, I think the Lakers have moved a little bit away from that, but yeah, there was still some feeling in this game. I know from fans, I know you were doing the live chat that, you know, the Lakers were getting the benefit of the calls, and there were quite a few times it seemed like Landry, especially in that game, got fouled, and nothing was called. But even if we put all of that aside, you know, I don't think it matters when you get dominated on the glass 43-30. And that in this game, just like in the entire series, the Hornets' leading rebounder was Chris Paul.
Mm-hmm.
That's I mean, that's something that's I know the next podcast we'll be talking about the future, but that's something that's got to be fixed.
All right. Yeah. And I mean, I'll say this. I've said it before. West being lost. He's not a terrific rebounder, but you cannot play one big man on two, because that's essentially what we were doing with Landry there. Landry is not a defensive rebounder. He can't box anyone out to save his life. So Okafor is having to worry about two guys. And, yeah, I mean, that doesn't excuse the low numbers he had, but it's impossible for one big man who's already undersized against both the big men he's playing against to be able to control the defensive glass. It's just not happening. And right. A few times we did win the rebounding battle was purely because our entire team crashed the defensive glass and managed to pull them out.
Right, which again takes away from the transition. And you say it was 2-on-1. I'll say 3-on-1 because I think the guy who just killed us in this series quietly was Ron Artest.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have Marco Bellinelli trying to box him out, or in some cases, Jarrett Jack. And that, you know, that was just impossible. I mean, to me, it felt like a situation where almost, you know, the Hornets had to pick their poison. And I would have liked to see either them put Landry at the three and just go big, mm-hmm. or put Ariza back in Artest and say, all right, Kobe, you got the mismatch. Just go ahead and fire up 25 shots with Willie Green or Marco Bellinelli on you.
Right.
You know, it's almost like that old strategy you had to take against the Bulls with, okay, Pippen and Jordan, we know you're going to score, so we're not going to put our best defenders on you. We're just going to stop everybody else. And if you two score 80 on us, then so be it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things that I regretted all series long was, you know, especially by Game 5. When you're going into Game 6, and I know Monty said something about, well, you know, it's been sort of work because we won two games, so you can't really rely on that. And when you get smoked in Game 5, it's do or die. You got to experiment a little bit, and he didn't. And yeah. I wanted to see that Gray, the Gray Okafor Landry lineup out there. I thought that was our only chance of being able to match their size. And I think we saw it like 4 minutes all series.
Yeah.
I thought that put us at a disadvantage. I mean, just run it out there for like, you know, half a quarter and see what happens.
Yeah, I noticed whenever we saw that or something close to that, there was a couple times when Banga and Gray were on the floor together that the Hornets' spacing on offense was just atrocious.
Right.
But again, it's a pick your poison thing. I mean, you're completely outmatched, outclassed, outskilled in the series. You know, I'd rather control the boards, and the Hornets are going to be a jump shooting team either way. So, you know, make Chris Paul into Allen Iverson circa, what, 2001,
mm-hmm.
and just put a bunch of size out there with him, have him take every shot if that's what it takes. But, yeah, I think that's what Monty is going to take out of the season more than anything. I think we saw a lot of teams adjust at halftime against the Hornets, and the Hornets not adjust with them, and this was kind of a larger scale version of that. You know, the Lakers made their adjustment in Game 3 and then again in Game 5. And Monty said, well, we won Game 1 and 4 with X, so we're just going to stick with X. And I think as he becomes more experienced, he's going to know that he can't do that.
Right. So there's only one last thing I wanted to talk about from the series, those last two games. And I'm kicking myself because I meant to go write down who said this. Chris Paul, game 6, was not Chris Paul from games 1 through 5. He was not aggressive. He was picking the ball up in strange places, like, you know, all the things that we complained about at the end of the season where, you know, he just didn't seem that into the game.
Yeah.
It was a little concerning, but I will agree with one thing. He was determinedly trying to get his teammates involved on offense, and, yeah, he wasn't taking shots he should be. I think, I mean, they were exactly right when they were saying, well, you know, if they're within at the end of a game with 6 minutes to go, that's when Chris Paul needs to be ready to take over. But you have to be in striking distance, and he can't keep them in striking distance all game long, consistently, all the time.
Right.
So I completely agree with him, just, you know, trying to force his teammates to keep them in it so that he can clean it up at the end.
And yeah, I mean, I've done those live chats before or seen other Hornets fans on other sites, and it seems like the Hornets get down 6 in the second quarter, and you hear 50 comments or read 50 comments about, okay, Chris, now it's time to take over. No, it's not even time now. Chris Paul is your closer. You don't put him in the 6th or 7th inning. I mean, he's going to get his buckets dropped, but his role on this team, when this team is playing best, is, you know, to get everybody else involved and then close out at the end. Anything else is just a short-term solution that eventually is just going to lead to a loss. So, you know, I could understand people's frustration, especially when guys like Willie Green are trying to create offense and you see Chris Paul do it so beautifully. Mm-hmm. You don't understand why every possession just doesn't end with a Chris Paul jumper, but long term, that's just not how this team's going to win.
And that's what you got. That's the major reason we missed West in this series, was Paul has to have that one guy who can create his own shot, and West is the only one on this team who could do that with any regularity and in any sort of way you'd want him to be. I mean, Landry has his moments here and there, Bellinelli sometimes, Green maybe, but they're never great shots. West is the only one who could get a pretty solid shot working on his own.
So, and I mean, I don't want us to try to project how this series would have went with David West, because that's futile. And Carl Landry did have his moments that, honestly, he probably wouldn't have had if he was only getting spot minutes. But just walking away from this series, I guess, big picture, how far do you feel like the Hornets are away from being a team that could win 4 playoff series?
Very far.
Very far as in a superstar and a quasi-all-star, as far as two quasi-all-stars?
Two quasi-all-stars away.
And David West healthy, right?
And
Chris Paul, David West, and two quasi-all-stars to go with Okafor and Ariza?
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one to say. I mean, we'll get to that a little bit later.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to get your feeling because last week on the podcast, we were jumping ahead of ourselves and talking about beating Dallas. So
yeah, I just think
a week later how far we are from that.
I don't think we're like, go get Andre Iguodala and suddenly we're a contender.
Okay. All right, interesting. Well, yeah, we'll get to that in part two of the podcast, but for now, I kind of wanted to just do our version of end-of-season meetings. You know, most fans know this, some might not, but at the end of every season, you know, the GM and coach will get together and talk and review the roster, and then the coach will usually sit down with the players, talk about, you know, how the season went and what that player should work on over the offseason and what they want to see back from them next year. Even if that player is an impending free agent, might not come back, you know, the coach does that. So, you know, I wanted the two of us to do that, for us to just kind of go through this roster, mm-hmm. talk about the guys, how their season was, and then, you know, what they could work on to be, you know, a part of this team next year. So, I guess, how about you break it up? You start off by...
Sure. There's
first.
Yeah, so I'll break it up into my three little categories. I like to do it where it's bigs, wings, and ball handlers. And it's funny because you look at the bigs, and for two positions on the team, you could really tell that Dell Demps was finally just saying, how much crap can I throw at the wall in the hope of something sticking? Because we have Okafor and West, and then Gray, Benga, Landry, Smith, Anderson. So, you know, that's seven people trying to fill two positions. So I guess we should start with Okafor, our starting center. What kind of grade would you give Okafor for the season?
I guess, it's so hard not to be a prisoner of the moment, because for the playoff series, you'd probably have to give him a C-, but for the season, it would be somewhere between an A- and a B+. So I guess I'll just average it all out and go with the B+. But this defense is completely different when Okafor is in the game, and especially when Okafor and David West were there together. Again, West isn't the best individual defender, but those guys really communicated well I just think, you know, this team, their record without Okafor this year was 2-10. 2-8. He missed 10 games. You know, and it was just so much that they were missing on that defensive end. I thought he was so solid on that side of the court. I thought he had his moments on the offensive side. The Miami game definitely stands out. There was other games where he was finishing around the basket, and he seemed to have developed a couple of moves. He had a couple of hook shots. He actually had a baseline jumper. I mean, I know that Utah jumper was complete luck, where in the game where Wes went down, he tied up the game. But, I mean, he really started to develop a 10 to 12 footer on the baseline. He had a couple of free throw jumpers over the course of the year. So we saw some new things offensively from him. But really, he was the defensive MVP, and this team probably at best would have been 36, 38 wins without Okafor. So I'll give him that B+, but I just really hope that he works on taking advantage. I think what I would have him work on the most is his second hop. So people, you know, they think about Dennis Rodman and what made him such an excellent rebounder. And he was smart and got position. But really what Dennis Rodman could do is he could get up on a second hop quicker than anybody else. And Okafor is not going to grow. He's not going to be 7'1" next year. He's going to be limited in that area all the time. But the second hop is something that he could work on. And you know, if you're going to go against a guy like Bynum or Gasol, they're going to be taller than you. But you have a chance to be quicker than them. You have a chance to get to certain spots and jump multiple times. I mean, Charles Barkley was, you know, he would get 12, 13 rebounds in this league at 6'4". So I do think there are things that he could work on, and that would be my advice to him and something that he could actually improve on, because he's not growing over the offseason. So that's my grade for Okafor.
I would give Okafor a B, maybe a B+. And it's more, yeah, absolutely. He's without him, our defense is bad, really bad. But probably that's partially because what he's being replaced by, which is even worse. I think my biggest gripe with Okafor and what I like him to work on, though this isn't something that typically you can improve, is just his feel for the game. I mean, you remember the Crescent City connection where Paul would dribble into the free throw line, seal a guy on his back, and the big man would have to run out of him, and he would hit that lob to Tyson at the basket over and over again. Okafor does not do that, and the reason why Tyson was able to pull that off was Tyson had a feel for the game where if his guy was overplaying slightly, he wouldn't set the pick and sit. He would roll immediately to the basket as fast as he could. And Okafor, when he sets a pick and stands there, like you're supposed to, what you're taught in college. But that doesn't allow you to get those kind of lobs over the top. He doesn't get that flexibility. I mean, you even saw like Aaron Gray and especially Landry, they would float to the open spots out just outside of the paint when Paul was penetrating. Okafor doesn't do that. He more stands under the basket getting ready for an offensive rebound. It's just solid, perfect fundamentals with Okafor with no genius or even grasp for the flow of the game. And, I mean, I don't know if that's something you can teach. I mean, maybe you can tell him, do this on this play. But that's really where I think Okafor is most limited.
I mean, is it possible that it could come with continuity? I mean, Okafor didn't exactly have, you know, steady veteran point guards in Charlotte. I mean, most of his career he's playing with journeymen, and then had Raymond Felton, who was still kind of finding his way throughout the league. Is there any way that as he continues to go on with this team and this system and specifically this point guard that could manifest?
Somebody will have to actually determinedly teach him to do that. I think when a player is like, it's, you know, year 7 and 8 in the league, they're almost set in their ways. He's not going to switch that unless, like, Monty decides to stick a big man coach in his ear who just sits there and say, you know, roll every once in a while, float to here, show him these places where he could be a little bit more effective.
Right. Yeah, last thing I want to mention on Okafor is, as far as a possible positive heading forward, is this guy, Larry Brown, basically said he wanted to get rid of Okafor because Okafor showed no passion. He was more interested in yoga, blah, blah, blah. This was Okafor's first time into the playoffs. This was his first time seeing what real basketball was. And he was frustrated and upset and just utterly humiliated through this series. He's going to go one of two ways. Either one, he's going to be driven further away from basketball, which, you know, by the looks on his face and his temperament, I just don't see that happening. Or two, this series is going to push him harder than he's ever, you know, been pushed in the off season, and he'll come back with new determination. So, I mean, I just, in a way, Okafor was a rookie because the postseason is a completely different game. This was his first time in it. I think that we could see him come back with a new intensity next year. So that'll just be something to look forward to early in the season to see. You know, basketball players could be humbled very quickly, and I think he was in this series. So we'll see how he takes it.
Right.
All right. Well, then moving forward, staying on big men, somebody that we talked about a little earlier in this podcast that you wanted to see more of, Aaron Gray. What's your grade, and if he does come back?
I mean, Gray played phenomenal in the playoffs. I can't say anything bad about what he tried to give us against the Lakers. I mean, of course, that is such a limited circumstance. You're not going to be playing two slow-footed big men in a game very often. And Gray on a pick and roll is perhaps one of the worst defenders in the league. I would give Gray a C. I mean, I think he is a perfectly adequate fourth big man on a team.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth big man. He's being, you know, pushed right now. Well, I mean, he would have been our fourth if West had stayed healthy, and I think he's fine in that role. I think, though, that fourth big men in this league get paid more than, you know, $1.2 million, and I think he'll be getting more than that. So, I mean, personally, I'd like to see Gray come back next year. I'd like to see him do his player option, and I'm perfectly willing to have him come back. I don't think he's the complete useless mess that some people think he is. So that's all I got to say about Gray.
Well, I mean, what would you have him, let's say he does come back, what would it be, what would you want him working on next
season? Well, I mean, if I was in a perfect world, I'd just have him continue to lose weight and build up his physical, you know, strength. I think he's got the instincts and the basketball skills to be a good basketball player.
Hmm.
I just don't think he has the agility because of his weight.
All right. Yeah, no, I agree. To me, the big hole in his game and the reason why he's not going to play or doesn't get consistent minutes on this team is exactly what you said, the pick-and-roll defense. I mean, he was just utterly exposed. I remember games, especially the Phoenix game, in which whoever he was covering just got whatever they wanted. And I think Gray is fantastic in certain matchups and completely limited in others. So if you go against a team like the Lakers, you know, Gray is perfect because he's got those size. They're traditional bigs who sit on the low post. But when you go against somebody like Phoenix, who has guys that, you know, pull you outside, run the pick and pop, Gray is pretty much is worthless against teams like that. So I just think he's so matchup specific that to me he's a fourth/fifth man, you know, big man tweener, just because there's going to be some matchups you absolutely can't use him.
Right. Which leads us to our next guy, who's, I would say, is almost the exact same thing, which is Benga. Good old DJ. I mean, he's got all the same agility issues. I mean, he's more explosive, and he's maybe physically stronger. I'm not sure about that. But, I mean, he does not... he has less of a grasp on the offensive end. I don't know. I would, if I had to pick between Gray and Benga, I'd pick Gray over Benga, so I would probably give Benga a D for the season.
Yeah. Yeah, solid D. I mean, he's entertainment value, though, might be a little higher. I mean, on both ends of the court. On the defensive end, he comes up with some astounding blocks.
Right.
On the offensive end, he takes some shots that just leaves you scratching your head.
And sometimes he beats them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've rarely seen somebody shoot a 6-foot air ball tested, and Bang has had a couple of them this year. But the funny thing is, if you watch him in warm-ups, I mean, this is the funny part to me, and where, as fans, we just wonder what players thinking, like, are they delusional? But if you go and watch the pregame workout and warm-ups, you're seeing Banga, like, constantly drill 14 and 16 footers. So this is where, like, the disillusion comes in, where, you know, I'm sure all of us can remember that the Peja, post-up from 22 feet turnaround that he would take seemingly twice a game and maybe make once every month or so. But he drilled those in practice and in warm-ups all the time, and it's the same way with Banga. But, yeah, I agree with you on the grade, but entertainment value and just pure hustle. I mean, he's not bad for a sixth big, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if he's at the end of your bench, I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, and I guess we could just breeze over a couple. I mean, Pops Mensa Bonsu, we barely knew you.
Right.
But impressively put up a negative 0.1 per. I've never seen a negative per. I didn't know they existed.
Yeah, they do.
And Pops was the only Hornet player this year to grab one. Also, you know, I don't think there's any chance that he'll be back, and he was very seldomly used, but David Anderson.
Right.
We hardly knew you, but he did have some moments, and to me seemed almost like a Jason Smith, but with further range.
Yeah, I didn't see tremendous difference between Anderson and Smith.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we'll get to Smith in a moment, but I think I preferred watching Anderson play to Smith.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just a little bit of more tenacity from Jason Smith on the offensive boards,
mm-hmm.
things of that nature. But, yeah, overall, to me, they were almost the same guy, except for Anderson could extend to the three-point line, where Jason Smith was 16 to 18 feet, seemed like his maximum.
So let me jump off on that really, really quick. Smith, actually, when he was in Philadelphia, would take three-pointers. I think he took, like, one all year this year. So if the 20-foot jump shot is the least efficient shot in the game, and even a bad shooter at three-point line is much more efficient than a 20-foot jump shot, why would you ask your player to pick and pop to the 20-foot range rather than pick and pop to the three-point line?
The only thing that I could think of is it's where Chris Paul wants his pick set. So if you think about it, if Chris Paul is getting the pick, I don't know, 2 feet inside the three-point line, it gives him more options to where if Jason Smith pops out, I don't know. I'm trying to come up with something here. I have nothing.
Yeah.
It doesn't make much sense. I mean, it has to be a spacing issue. And
I mean, it's not just the Hornets who do this. I mean, everybody does this. I mean, Dallas does it all the time. I mean, it's a standard set, but it always makes me wonder, I mean, is it real? I mean, does taking that extra step out past the three-point line? I mean, there's always this concept of range. But how real is that? I mean, does it make a real difference between shooting at 20 feet and shooting at 23 feet? It doesn't seem like it would.
It has to at some point, right? Because, I mean, this is the old question in philosophy, but at some point, X plus 1 has to be dramatically different than X. So if you're saying that from 20 to 23, then I'll say to you, how come there's not guys taking 42-foot jumpers? Because 42 isn't that different from 41, and then we could work it all the way back to the three-point line. So, yeah, I mean, at some point...
Antoine Walker would tell you because you can't shoot four-point shots.
Because of the backcourt violation. Yeah. It is a difference. It's something that can be improved with time. Usually it's a strength difference. But, no, I agree with you. I mean, the Spurs have a much more efficient Jason Smith, and his name is Matt Bonner.
Yeah.
I mean, Matt Bonner doesn't do anything. But, you know, he provides that threat from the three-point line, and because of that, he's incredibly more efficient, although sitting at home just like Jason Smith right now. So,
right. So we got two more bigs to talk about, and they're inextricably linked. So David West, Carl Landry.
Both. All right, I'll take Landry.
Okay.
Landry, I'm gonna have to give a B minus two with this Hornets team. One, before West went down, I mean, I know everybody loves to talk about Carl Landry as the savior because without him, you know, the David West hole would have been so big. But before David West went down, Carl Landry, you know, wasn't giving this team much, and there were even times where Monty was shorting his rotation to the point where Landry wasn't getting on the court. I know people don't remember that, but he wasn't really playing that good of basketball. All of a sudden, West goes down, and now, you know, he's a much more focal point of the offense. But to me, if you're truly an efficient player, and when Landry, in all actuality, wasn't his best, it's when he was a sixth man who could make a huge impact in 24, 25 minutes. And he didn't show that at all with the Hornets. What he did show was really good play when he got 35 to 40 minutes. But in reality, Carl Landry is not going to get 35 to 40 minutes from a championship contending team. He's just not a legitimate starting power forward in this league. So I give him a B minus because although he did play well, he didn't play well in the role that the Hornets would actually need him for moving forward. So I'm a little bit worried if the Hornets do bring this roster back with David West, you know, going to be the starter if and, you know, when he comes back next year. I worry a little bit about, you know, Carl Landry and how effective he's going to be as a sixth man. So my advice to him in the offseason would just be to get that hunger back that he had in his first couple years where you didn't know if you were going to, you know, be pulled 2 minutes into, you know, your rotation or if you were going to be on the court longer. So you just played 110% all the way on both ends of the court and on both glass, offensive and defensive glass. So that would be my grade for Landry on the year.
Yeah, I agree with your grade for Landry. I mean, offensively, it's hard to really give him any sort of difficulty over his struggles. I mean, he was with a brand new team. He was coming from a complete disaster of a team. I mean, he's just, it's hard to settle into any sort of situation that you don't know at all and be able to operate offensively in basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, so normally I would probably give him a B plus because even though he was doing that, he was still fairly efficient as a scorer. I mean, he was more efficient than the rest. But that you hit the nail on the head. Rebounding, I mean, he was not a good rebounder at Sacramento. And his last year in Houston, he was only a mediocre rebounder. He was an awful rebounder as a Hornet.
And it's so frustrating because offensive rebounds are harder to come by than defensive ones, but he did that much better than he did, you know, on the defensive board. So, you know, to me, you know he's capable of it.
Right.
So it just frustrates you, like, why isn't he putting in that same effort?
Well, actually, I mean, I'm not sure if I can say that entirely. I think on the offensive boards, you can get away with being more sneaky and slipping around people sometimes. I think on the defensive boards, as a defender, you're reliant a lot more on the solid box out, being able to keep your guy away from the glass. It's a different role. You're on the interior. And I think Landry cannot box, you know, NBA big men out.
So let me ask you this. I mean, before we get to David West, you say they're linked. If everybody does come back on this team next year, can Carl Landry and David West get minutes together on the court playing the 4 and 5?
Yeah. It won't be very good defensively.
Okay.
Or rebounding.
All right.
There are some major limitations to that, and I wouldn't want to see a lot of it.
Yeah, but, I mean, then again, would David West have been that much worse of a rebounder than Okafor was in this series?
True.
So, all right, go ahead. David West.
So, David West, you know, and here's the thing. You know, I just a few days ago said he was our MVP. And here's the thing that I always come back to with David West, and I know I was going to piss off a whole lot of people, but one of the very basic tenets of advanced statistics is you want to players who are better than average at multiple things. In order for you to build a team that can contend and produce on the court, You have to have multiple players with multiple things they're really good at. And the Hornets, of course, have Chris Paul, who's better at everything he does than a common point guard. Mm-hmm. But David West has always been the second banana, and he has never been better in more than one category than his peers. He's usually average in most of them, or slightly below average, but he's never been better than anyone except for just pure points. I'm not even talking efficiency. Just the ability to take shots, manufacture shots for himself. He's better than most power forwards in the game. But when it comes to efficiency, his rebounding's gotten worse, so that's not, he used to be moderate there. He's getting worse. His passing is not better. His blocks are not better. His steals are not better. I mean, it's kind of, he doesn't get enough free throws. So he's a good finisher, but because he doesn't get enough, he's not considered a better, you know, free throw generator. So West is part of the problem, and it hurts me like hell to say that because West was my favorite player for 2 years with the Hornets. Last year he was awful, but this year he came back, and I felt the old, you know, oh, David West, I love watching him play. But I think West is part of the problem.
But is he part of the problem because he's miscast? If I got you a second banana, as you call it, in there tomorrow, and David West was now your third option, is he a problem anymore? I mean, is he a problem in general, or is he just a problem because he's miscast on this team?
So David West is almost a purely neutral producer for you. So he's not even, like, miscast as, I mean, you could have him be like a third banana. Yes, you could do that. I don't think you're going to be able to pay David West as a third banana.
Mm-hmm.
So, because, you know, they always, this is one of those things they always say, the advanced statistics guys, you know, being able to manufacture points manufactures you a huge paycheck, whether or not you're efficient at getting those. So, I mean, I don't even know what I'm saying here. I mean, what, do we get rid of West? You can't get rid of him now because he's injured, so he's not going to be worth diddly compared to what he was a few months ago. And even when he was worth something, you weren't going to get it. A actual star back.
Right.
So I mean, it's like he's perfectly rated as a not quite all-star kind of, you're never going to get over the top with him.
Yeah, I mean, so you're saying if we were to bring, I guess who would be, if you're thinking about it as the Hornets having a big three, and David West becoming that third, Chris Paul is obviously the first. Give me your ideal number two.
Dwight Howard. Sorry.
Okay.
I had to say Dwight Howard. No, I mean...
So you would take Howard over Durant. I guess what I'm asking is...
No,
Durant,
that's the same kind of level. Durant and Howard are the exact same kind of thing.
I know they're the same kind of level. I guess I'm trying to ask, are you looking more... For a score that takes the scoring burden off of West, or would you be looking more for a defender and a low post guy who takes those responsibilities off of West?
We would need West to cut back on his shot slightly.
Uh-huh.
And we'd need somebody who could fill two stat columns that he doesn't touch. I mean, and it's the same thing as like a fantasy roto, you know, one of those fantasy leagues where you have to be good at a whole bunch of different categories. The same
right.
is true in the NBA. Yeah, you can, you know, ditch one category or two categories, but if you don't do well, better than average in, you know, good 80% of your categories, you're not winning. And the same is true in the NBA. So you got to look at all those things that West doesn't do, and you got to find some, I mean, Chris Paul will fill a couple of them, but you got to find somebody else to fill the other ones. So yeah, I mean, if you could find the next Dikembe Mutombo,
yeah. I mean, okay. I see what you're saying. I guess on a team that has a chance of winning the title this year, is there anybody you could compare West to? Like, I'm thinking by what you're saying, I'm hearing a lot of Ray Allen. I mean, is that fair? Where now Ray Allen has gone from the number one guy in Seattle to he's the number three, perhaps even number four guy on the Celtics, who basically specializes, gets points, erupts every once in a while.
Yeah.
But for the main point, you're not looking for him to fill out a bunch of categories. Would that be fair?
Yeah, Ray Allen is perfect. I mean, I've gone to this before. He's got to be our Robert Parrish kind of guy because I watched the Celtics when I was growing up with my
father.
And on that team, McHale and Bird were finishing. They were the ones who were going to get you points at the end of the game when everything buckled down and you had to get something. But for the first two, three quarters, Robert Parrish would come in and get his 20 points and work, when the pressure wasn't quite as great. That's what David West needs to be. Just keep you in the game so that the two big actual stars can control the game enough to finish it at the end.
All right. Yeah, I like that. All right. So let's move on to the wings. We got so who do you have in this category? Who's a wing? Who's a ball handler?
So with the wings, I got Ariza, Poindexter, Bellinelli, and Green. Paul and Jack are our only ball handlers, and Jack's a questionable ball handler. But he can bring the ball up. So wings, Ariza, Poindexter, Bellinelli, and Green.
Wait a minute. I didn't hear any Marcus Banks in there anymore.
I actually had Marcus Banks with a little asterisk next to him. But, yeah, Marcus was awesome for us this year. But, I didn't feel – I felt that, it would be a disservice to Chris Paul if we talked about how much better Marcus Banks was than him.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll start off with, I guess – I don't know who the most polarizing guy on that list is. That's
all of them.
Yeah, it really is. But I guess I'll start off with Trevor Ariza.
Right.
And Ariza, I'm going to give a C-2 because, again, same as Okafor, I'm not going to be prisoner of the moment because I think in the playoffs he definitely raised that grade considerably.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking at him in the context of starting small forward in the NBA. And I'll say this for our wing position in general. I don't think there is a worse shooting guard / small forward combo in the NBA. Now, there definitely is not one of all the teams that made the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a couple of the bottom feeders. I mean, you might look at teams that just aren't experienced, like Minnesota, but they have guys like Wesley Johnson who are up and coming who I would take over our guys any day, but in the playoffs, for sure, this is the worst perimeter, lineup. So, Ariza, I'm comparing to other small forwards in the NBA and what he's capable of and what he did this season. I mean, his shooting numbers were all-time historically bad.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's one of those things where you see games where he's capable of so many other things, and it's frustrating to watch because every ninth or tenth game, Monty Williams will come out and say, yeah, I told Ariza he's got to attack the basket more. And then he'll start attacking and do better. And then before you know it, he's drifting out to the three-point line again. It's like, I don't know, it's just not something that he gets constantly. He just has bad habits that definitely weren't consistently broken this year. And, that's all I would say to him in the off season to work on is, look, you taking it to the hole, you not settling for these bad jump shots where I'll sit down with you, Trevor, and show you the stats. You're one of the worst outside shooters in the NBA and one of the all-time worst in the history of your position. This is obviously not something that you could do. I mean, it's just got to get beaten into his head that's not the way that the Hornets are going to win games. For every bad shot he takes, he's going to have to work that much harder on defense because the Hornets are going to have to win games 94-90, with inefficient offenses. So that's my grade, and that's moving forward on to next year, although I will say that I was slightly encouraged by the playoffs. I'm just wondering if it was because it finally clicked. Was it because he was playing against his old team and he was fired up? Was it because it was the playoffs? All of the above, some of the above. But either way, I want to see that carry into next year, and I want to get 82 games of that Trevor Ariza.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't disagree with your rating. I mean, he's a zero-sum guy in the end because his offense is so brutally bad the tone, even though he sets a tone on the defensive end, of it doesn't end up giving us anything. And if anything, he's a net negative because his offense is so unbelievably awful most of the time.
Yeah, and I mean, he was in that rare 40-30-70 club.
Mm.
You know, they talk about the 50-40-90 club as being exclusive, but he's exclusive on the other end. Is, you know, he upped his percentages a little bit at the end of the year, but I mean, they were just awful.
Right.
But I'll give you the other starter in our little set, Marco Bellinelli.
All right. So I got to say something. Marco started off the year really impressing me on the defensive end. He was working hard there. That ended probably 2 months into the season. And I saw him. He was slightly better at contesting larger guys. But he got thrown around too much and got exposed. And he seemed to wear down defensively. And he's too streaky on the offensive end to make up for that. So I would give our good pal Marco Bellinelli probably a D+.
And now, if he was a reserve, I mean, is that because he's a starter?
That's because he's a starter.
Okay, and you're just comparing him against other starters, and you're saying he's a bottom five or so starter in the league at that position.
Well, yeah, so let me put it, just taking, I mean, if I had a rotation in the NBA at the two swing positions, shooting guard and small forward, I could see Ariza in a three-man rotation there as a possible starter, as a, you know, the third man off the bench, in any of those roles. Marco Bellinelli would be a fourth person. He would be the one who comes in spot minutes to, you know, when those three guys aren't working out.
I mean, it seems to me, though, it looks like if teams are sacrificing any one position in the starting lineup and still being successful, it seems to be that it's that shooting guard position. I mean,
mm-hmm.
have the best record in the NBA with Keith Bogans.
Right.
Oh, the Jazz have done it for years. Is there any way that Marco could be, you know, a Keith Bogans type of, obviously he's a hole, but does he do anything else?
Well, he's David West light, except, so, you know, I went into that long spiel about David West being not better in any stat or slightly worse. Marco Bellinelli is that, but worse. So he's slightly better at 3-point shooting. And then every other stat, except for turnovers, because he never really dribbles that much, he is way below average. He is a way below average rebounder for his position. His assists per game are half what they should be. His steal per games are half what they should be. He is, I mean, if you're going to have him be in your starting lineup, you have to make up a lot.
All right, so he comes to you, you're Monty Williams, and Monty, what are you telling him? What can he work on over the summer that if the Hornets are forced to start him again next year, you know, what's something realistically that he could work on and come back where he would be a solid contributor?
I think he shows all the potential that he could be very good off the dribble.
Uh-huh.
He needs to slow down. And learn some of those hesitation moves that Chris Paul pulls off. Because Bellinelli is either I'm taking the three-pointer or you're running at me and I'm going as fast to the basket as possible and then either taking a shot or dumping it.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't have a lot of those go and hesitate, get defenders, you know, backpedaling and then taking the shot or pushing it more. So it's more like that, what to do in the mid-range when you're going in.
Yeah, and I think people will cite his 3-point percentage numbers from earlier in the year, but for me, what I loved early in the year was he had a lot of those pump fakes where he would just take a dribble in,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he would hit an open jumper or he would attack the basket more, and it just seemed like he almost became a caricature at the end of the year where it was going to be a three from the corner, even sometimes very tightly contested, or pretty much nothing, and yeah, you're right. He has to develop something in the middle of that.
Yep. All right, so we got Willie Green to talk about, who Fariza's not the most polarizing guy on this team. Willie Green is it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think this just comes down to me. Whether or not you like Willie Green tells me a lot about what you want from your NBA team. Because I don't think anybody could argue. One, Willie Green to me was the only Hornet that showed up every single game with 100% intensity.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, that game at Philadelphia, I don't know why that one out of all the games this season stick out in my mind, but I was so disgusted by the Hornets' performance that game. Almost everybody took off. Willie was, you know, I know he played in Philly, so he had to add an incentive. But just every single game that guy played so hard, you want to see who the cheerleader is on the bench. Every single time the camera swoops to the bench, or if you're there watching it live, Willie is the first one encouraging. Me personally, going to the games and being behind the scenes in the locker room, he is the first one working out. He's always active. Like, he absolutely loves the game. But the guy just doesn't have very much talent.
Mm-mm.
So, I mean, as a grade for the season, for his role, I would give him a C, very average, and that's because some nights he had A games, like the game where he started off 12 for 12 against Phoenix, and then other nights he would have F games. And honestly, in the playoffs, I just had a feeling that he was very nervous
mm-hmm.
in those games. I mean, he had the air ball free throw in game one. He had some turnovers that were uncharacteristic even for him. I don't know. It's he's the epitome of what we have to remember about this Hornets team, and that's that all of these guys are either new to the team or new to each other in some kind of way. I mean, this is the first season in a system, first season in a new place. You know, and Willie Green was that. He had his ups and downs, but to me, he's the perfect fourth guard on a team. If there's some way that he's just an 8 to 12 minute guy, but he's in a way an assistant coach to younger guys and kind of that energy, I think it would be perfect. I think sometimes he was asked to do too much, and on rare nights he came through, and on other nights he just had Hornets fans pull their hair out. So, you know, if I could just have him working on anything in the off season, it would really just be getting to know multiple positions on this offense and where those places are. I think that he might be asked, if he comes back, to play multiple positions and really to act as more of a tutor to other guys that the Hornets might bring in. So it would really just be learning this offense to play almost in an assistant coach type of role, similar to what Eric Snow did in Cleveland in his last couple of years, where he got some playing time, but really he was just a go-between the vets and the young guys. So that's my grade for Willie.
Yeah, there isn't a word that you said there that I disagree with. I mean, Hollinger for years has always said he never understood why Willie got as many games. I mean, he's at 499 regular season games played now, and he started a good number of them. And like you said, he doesn't have that much talent. And
no.
It's because he works like a dog.
Yep.
And coaches appreciate that. But he doesn't have the talent to be a rotation player.
Yeah, there's a reason Rudy Rudiger only got one snap at Notre Dame.
Right.
You know,
right.
Rudy didn't have the talent. He had the heart. But Notre Dame wasn't stupid enough to make him their starting defensive end.
Right.
So Willie, you know, if he's a fourth guard on a team getting, you know, fewer minutes, I think fans will love him. I don't think that he could be getting as much burn as he did this year. But that'll lead us to our last one for this category, Coupon.
All right. We talked about him a little bit when our guest Scott was on. And, I mean, I don't really have a lot to add about that. Coupon, we did not see you very much this year. And when we did see you, we didn't see a lot of reasons why we should see you a lot this year. I mean, there was a couple moments, but really, we need to see a lot more out of you.
if I could, okay, I'll give you a couple of things, and you're only allowed to pick one for him to do this summer. Either one, shoot 500 three-pointers a day. Two, be in the weight room and essentially add on 15 pounds. Or three, just work on his ball handling skills to try to become almost a point forward or creator in the system. Which would you choose for him?
I think I'm going to be picking a different thing than you are.
Okay.
But I think he needs to put on the weight. I mean, for some reason, Poindexter struck me as small.
Yeah.
And he's got to make his living on being a defensive player. And, yeah, hitting that corner three, but he shot 36% from three this year, which is not bad. I mean, it's slightly below average. So if you're just sticking him in the corner to take that shot, you live with 36% as long as he gives you something defensively. And it's not even just defensively. If he has that strength, he was going to the basket this year, but he wasn't able to finish at the rim. And it was because he wasn't getting up there. He was getting kind of bothered by the strength of the players he's going against. I think he's got to get the NBA body, and I think he'll become a usable player.
Yeah, no, actually, that is exactly what I would pick. And here's the other thing I think those 15 pounds could do. Let me just ask you a question. Who on this Hornets team do you remember taking a charge this year? Not a flop where in the post, you know, a guy swung his elbow and they fell. Well, but I mean James Posey or Big Baby step into the middle of the lane and just take a charge.
Other than Willie? I can't remember anybody, really.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Quincy has a chance to be that little intangible guy.
Yeah.
And putting on the weight, you know, I would add everything to what you said and also give him that added element. One other guy I want to mention, I know he's not on here, and I know he didn't get much run with the Hornets, but I'm going to tell you right now that not only will Patrick Ewing Jr. be on this team next year, but he will get significant rotation minutes throughout the year.
Really?
I know people didn't see much of him, but if you want to talk about the prototype of what Dell Demps has learned and the type of guys that the Spurs have got and also the type of guys that Bonnie loves. I mean, if you guys are on Twitter, you're probably a little annoyed by now. Patrick Ewing sends out probably 20 religious quotes per day, and they're uplifting at first and a little tiresome afterwards. But, I mean, he's a very passionate guy. He's, very, very spiritual in that way, but he's also a tireless worker. And I'm telling you right now, he's by far the most athletic player on the Hornets roster. And I just think that, you look around the NBA at all these teams, especially the small market ones, and all of those teams are getting significant contributions from guys who are making $1.5 million or less this year. You know, only teams like the Lakers could afford to pay all their rotational players $4, 5, 6, 7, 8 million. I mean, you look at San Antonio and getting guys like Gary Neal or even Memphis now as guys like Darrell Arthur, and you know, they have these young, cheap guys on their roster that are allowing them to go and pay their other superstars. Right now, the Hornets have Quincy Poindexter and nobody else fitting that description. So I think Patrick Ewing will come back and, he'll get some minutes next year.
Okay.
To the ball handlers. I'll take Jarrett Jack.
So Jarrett Jack, you want to start with Jarrett Jack?
Yeah, it'll be like the pregame introductions. I'll save CP3 for last.
Honestly, and this is, I almost feel silly saying this, but I would prefer that if the Hornets had the choice, that they had no shooting guard that they could bring in, and we were basically faced with, you know, the ability to bring back the exact same backcourt rotation we had this year, but there was the opportunity of bringing in another backup point guard, I would rather they bring in a backup point guard and start Jarrett Jack at the shooting guard.
I completely agree. I was actually going to talk about one of our off-season needs in our next podcast being being a backup point guard, because I don't think Jared Jack is a point guard.
Yeah, I think he's fine next to Paul.
Yeah, I think he's fine there, and even, you know, another system, and that's why I just think it would be great if the Hornets could find, you know, somebody who could handle the ball either at the two or three position in that second unit. But I love Jack playing over at the two guard spot.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, I recognize he's got some defensive limitations, and we'll need somebody who can, you know, maybe guard someone a little bit bigger at times with Jack out there, but. I mean, Jack, with his offense ability, his ability to break down an attack, and yes, he doesn't take the best shots all the time in the world, but he got so much better as the season went on. He had career lows in field goal percentage and three-point percentage, but by the end of the season, they were up much more closer to what his career averages are. And if he gave us a full season at his career averages, which are 44% and 35%, and, you know, his good free throw shooting that he's just clever as hell at getting, I think he would be a very valuable contributor. Now, I'm not saying that the Chris Paul, Jarrett Jack backcourt would win us championships, but if Jarrett Jack is your weakest starter on a team, you could be.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, in a vacuum, there's not a problem with Jarrett Jack as a starting shooting guard. The problem is when he's your starting shooting guard, David West or Carl Landry are your starting small or power forward, and then Okafor is your starting center.
Right.
You know, at that point, you're just far too undersized. I mean, I've seen other teams get by with the two-point guard backup, but usually they have bigs deterring people from coming into the lane, and I just think at that point, it gets too much to handle. You have a healthy Tyson Chandler at center instead of Okafor, or with Okafor. You know, and this is a different conversation. I just don't know how you could be undersized. And honestly, in today's NBA, Chris Paul is an undersized point guard.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have four guys who in almost every game are going to be smaller than their counterpart. That's my only problem with Jack at shooting guard, is if this team stays the way it is, it's almost too much to be outsized at every position.
Yeah. All right.
Now on to CP3. Did we give Jack a grade?
Oh, so I would give Jack, for the whole season, I would give Jack a B-.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was going to say the exact same thing. And a lot of it is because, again, we have to remember that these guys were just coming in to a new system, haven't played together. I mean, the best teams in this league have played with each other. There's a couple of exceptions. Obviously, we all know Boston in 2008. But for the most part, teams play their best basketball when these players really know each other. And Jack started off poorly, but once he really got to know the personnel and once Del Demp stopped making trades and this roster kind of flattened out, Jack really stepped up. So. All right, I'll give him the same grade, and on to you with Mr. CP3.
All right, so if I'm going to give CP3 a grade, I would give him an A-. I'm tempted to give him an A because when you look at the landscape of NBA point guards, he's, you know, top three for the regular season. Of course, in the playoffs, he was the best point guard and maybe the best player. But we had those unbelievably frustrating moments with Paul all season long, which I still have no answer for. I'm still just completely flabbergasted. So I give him an A- because I didn't know which Chris Paul was going to show up from game to game. And I mean, it's kind of ridiculous because I remember, you know, Chris Paul will come in and give us like, you know, 8 or 10 points and 15 assists. And you ask more than half the teams in the league if they could get a point guard who gave you that. I mean, hell, Rajon Rondo was the toast of the town because he was averaging 10 points and 15 assists for the first month or two of the season.
Right.
So I'm disappointed in Chris Paul for doing that for me in some of these games, which is ridiculous. But, that's not what we expect from Chris Paul. We expect the top five superstar. So I got to give him an A-.
Yeah, and I think that's where it all comes down to what are we grading him against? And for me, I'm grading Chris Paul against himself, and that's probably not fair. But I think when we look back, like, let's imagine people still collected basketball cards. We look at Chris Paul's basketball card at the end of his career. I think this is going to be a season that stands out where you go, whoa, what happened this year? Was he hurt? Was he, you know, to me, it just wasn't a Chris Paul year overall. It was definitely a Chris Paul playoffs, but I give him a B only because, you know, those 2007, 2008, and then the following year, 2008, 2009, were two of the greatest seasons ever. We saw that he's capable of that again in the playoffs, and we just didn't get any of it during the season. So, you know, I give him a B, but I'm really hopeful that with the summer and perhaps an extended summer, that knee could really get back to 100%. And if we could get, you know, if we could get the talents of Chris Paul from a couple of years ago combined with the increased IQ and hunger that he has, and perhaps, you know, a couple of better teammates, I think Chris Paul could easily have an MVP year next year.
Yeah, I mean, you got to look at everything except for 3-point percentage, and I guess free throw percentage. Chris Paul had his career low, or tied his career low, in every single category.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the one for me that stands out is 11.6 field goal attempts. Like, above everything, I mean, that's attempts. That has nothing to do with percentages, or he's in control of how many attempts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact that he's taken 4 shots a game more than Willie Green, or, you know, 3 more a game than Marco Bellinelli,
right.
That's just, you know, that's not what a superstar does. I don't care the position. And especially when you see how effective it is the other way, you know, in the playoffs. So you wrote that great article about him becoming more John Stockton and less Isaiah Thomas. I think that we saw in the playoffs that that's not the long-term Chris Paul, and I just hope that we get back to the guy that we knew for an entire season next year.
Yeah, there's only one last stat I wanted to throw out about Chris Paul, and this blows my mind. Chris Paul's career number of field goal attempts per game is 14. He just obliterated the Lakers in six games. Just, you know, was clearly the best player on the court for most of that series. And he was actually only taking 12.8 shots per game.
Yeah.
He was still taking less shots than he has throughout the rest of his career per game, and was averaging 22 points and just tearing up the place. This guy can control, this guy can control any game. He just has to have the help next to him, and it'll be amazing.
I agree, and that's it for the players. Just real quick, I mean, that's not all that this Hornets team is. We also have Monty Williams and Dell Demp, so I guess each one of us take one of them. Is there any one that you'd like to talk about more than the other and just give them the grade on the season?
So I guess, I mean, I actually have the makings of an article I was going to write about Dell Demps. So I guess I'll go with Monty, and I'll save my comments about the Demps a little later. Honestly, I think Monty, for a rookie coach, has done a phenomenal job. You don't typically see a coach come in and put their stamp on a team like this when they're a rookie coach with no pedigree. I mean, people, you know, Thibodeau won the Coach of the Year. He absolutely deserved to win the Coach of the Year. But he came in with the pedigree. Everybody knew who Thibodeau was. He had been on multiple teams that had incredible defenses. So everybody knew what they were getting, what they should be expecting. Monty Williams was fairly unheralded. And he came in and he got this team to play exactly the way he wanted them to play. And I mean, yeah, I'll always be a little upset about what happened with, you know, the Marcus Thornton thing. And there's always times where I quibble about rotations, but I will say this about rotations. I will never have a coach of my team that I will always agree 90% of the time with his rotations. I will always have a better rotation in my head that would have worked, damn it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how most fans are, but they don't give them the credit. I mean, to me, I think every fan would have been screaming to take Jarrett Jack out of game four of the playoffs, because Jarrett Jack had 0 points in 47 minutes and 50 seconds, was absolutely worthless that whole game, and then Monty leaves him in and he winds up winning the game for the Hornets, but nobody ever acknowledges that in favor of Monty. They'll just tell you about all the times he made the mistakes, but I'll agree with that. And on Dell Demps, I will give a B+, and it's not just because of the moves. I thought the moves were great, but I don't think people really, 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 really grasp how impossible of a situation Dell Demps was put into.
Yeah.
I mean, if Chris Paul is 22 and he has a couple years left in the contract, if the Hornets actually have an owner, let's say, if he has time to build, then I don't think Dell Demps would have pushed the panic button on, or at least that's how it's perceived in some areas. I think that he might have held on with Darren Collison or Marcus Thornton, or at least, you know, kind of cultivated those assets, let them grow a little more, search for certain opportunities. But you just got to put yourself in his shoes. The first day on the job, he has a meeting with his superstar in which they essentially sit down. Chris Paul says, all that matters to me is winning. And essentially that puts Dell Demps on a 2-year timeline of, okay, I've got to get this guy veterans around him that it could help him win today and then somehow not absolutely obliterate the future as well. So I just think it's a little unfair to criticize some of his moves as if he had the same situation every other GM has. Mm-hmm. He has a superstar that he needs to hold on to. He has a franchise that's on the verge of being moved somewhere else. He just got every single thing against him where he has to win now. And I think he executed, you know, some very good moves while giving up some possible future pieces. The truth is, I think if Marcus Thornton makes it as a quality player in this league, a guy who's in a rotation on a playoff championship team, it won't be till he's 27, 28, 29 years old. I mean, Jason Terry, a guy who a lot of people compare him to, was always a good scorer. He didn't really figure out how to play the game until his late 20s, and I think it's going to be a similar trajectory with Marcus Thornton. And the fact is, Dell Demps just doesn't have that kind of time. So I think when people criticize things like that, it's kind of not fair because of the position he was put in. So overall, I'll give him a B+.
Yeah, I won't disagree with that. I think that was a marvelous summary.
Marvelous.
Marvelous, darling.
This is why we pay you billions of dollars a year.
But we agreed way too much on this podcast. We're going to have to do another one where we come back and talk about the future, because I know there's going to be a lot of disagreement on that one.
I was kind of expecting you to argue with me about David West.
No, I mean, I felt that way for a while. I think you're going to have to put a Dwight Howard next to him, and maybe that's a solution we'll give for the next podcast, but,
just go get Dwight Howard.
Yeah.
And don't give up David West.
We're the only team in the league that wants him.
Right.
All right, well, that's it. Anything else you want to say about this 2011 season?
I mean, the only thing I wanted to say was, in some respects, I mean, the highs for this season and the lows of this season were absolutely insane. Am I not the only one who just thinks it's really funny that the playoffs ended up mirroring the regular season so closely? With, you know, that incredible start in both of them that just got everybody's expectations so insanely high. And then, you know, a little stretch where everybody, okay, maybe I was a little over, you know, got a little back to normal. Because you've missed the 2 games against the Lakers and the Hornets lose all those games. And then suddenly there's another game where everybody's like, oh my God, these Hornets can do it all.
Yeah.
And then peters out in the end.
And you just get, I mean, like, you know, I apparently come across as the biggest pessimist in the world, and I get sucked in. Yeah. I remember, you know, halfway through the first quarter of game five, I got up to take a piss after drinking far too much, and I honestly started thinking about a column in my head that I was going to write where the summary was basically going to be that maybe the Hornets are just a better team. Like, basically that this isn't luck. Maybe they're just the better team. Like, I got that delusional from this team, and then they go out and get crushed over the next six quarters, seven quarters, whatever. So, yeah, this team is capable of doing that to anybody. I mean, you could always find ways of talking yourself into this either being the best team in the NBA or one of the worst. Like, you have legitimate arguments on each side of that conversation.
Yep. All right. So thanks, everybody, to listening to In the Know. I don't have a great closing as usual, so just have a good day.
Good night. Let's have the phone talk, really, each and every day.